Thanks very much for the kind introduction. So I wanted just to say a couple of things about the work I've been interested in, mostly over the past year or so. So hopefully there should be pretty much no overlap with the talk I gave about a year and a bit ago here. But apologies if there is any tiny bits repeated. So anyway, most of what I've been thinking about is through the lens of logical structure and how we can do better than kind of our standard analyses, and in particular, go beyond the kind of two-point function assumptions. So in order to motivate this a little bit, I want to start by thinking of the universe sort of right back very, very early times. So picture on the left is CMB times, some math of the universe at redshift 1090, which is probably familiar to everyone on the Zoom. And the point which I wanted to point out here is that in this regime, the density field is very Gaussian. So the density is well described by a multivariate normal distribution with zero mean and some variance, which is just equal to the power spectrum. And this is important because in our simplest models, if it's Gaussian, it means that all of the information is contained within the power spectrum. So once I tell you the power spectrum, we're done. We have all the stuff we need to know, neglecting primordial non-Gaussianity, which I'll come back to in a bit. So the interesting thing about this is that we don't need any statistics beyond the power spectrum. And before I say a few words about what the universe looks like today, I just want to actually mention this power spectrum in a little bit more detail. So this is a plot of the linear power spectrum, which again is probably familiar to everyone here. Yet I'm bringing it up just to illustrate a couple of features of interest. So if you look at the power spectrum on the larger scales, effectively what we're seeing here is information about inflation, so from NS and AS in particular. We go to intermediate scales, we get matter radiation equality peak, giving us this little hump here. Smaller scales still, we get baryon acoustic oscillations. And if we go to the smaller scales, we get information about baryon and neutrino suppression. And the interesting thing about this is if we want to measure some cosmological parameter, say the Hubble constant, there's often multiple ways to do it. Like we can measure the Hubble constant both from the wiggly bits here and also the overall peak. Or baryons, we can measure them both from the wiggles and also suppression. So I bring this up mostly kind of to remind you that logical structure isn't just about these baryon acoustic oscillation wiggles. The power spectrum contains a lot more information if we're able to extract it. And I'll come back to that in a bit. So having said then what the early universe is like, let's think about the late universe. So of course, we have gravitational collapse, we have structure formation. And the thing that's relevant for this talk is that all of that fun physics of gravity makes sure that the density field today is no longer well described by a Gaussian. So even on large scales, this multivariate normal distribution doesn't hold. And for our purposes, it means that the power spectrum does not contain all the information. So if we do an analysis just using the power spectrum, we necessarily miss some features. So we're going to need to include some kind of higher order statistics in our analysis. So what sort of statistics should we use? Well, the simplest ones are pretty much basic extensions of the Gaussian statistics. So in your Gaussian case, we have this power spectrum I've been talking about, which is simply the squared for a space density field, or the two-point correlation function, which is two density fields at different locations. So of course, the simplest thing we could do is simply to take these two density fields and add a third one. So these would be the guys shown on the right here. We've got the bispectrum or three-point function. And this is really going to be the main statistic I'm going to be talking about because it's the simplest extension to our Gaussian cases, and it works well in this limit of weak non-Gaussianity. So I should say both of these guys on the right should be zero if we're in the Gaussian regime. Like for the CMB, they should be zero, neglecting sort of lensing and more complicated physics like that. Of course, we can go beyond this. If we wanted the four-point function, it would be exactly the same. We just have an extra dot on this plot on the right, or the trispectrum just being the Fourier space equivalent of that. And I'll say a little bit about the four-point function later on. So in order to understand why we actually care about the bispectrum, it's worth thinking about its physical form. So what I've shown in the top equation here is the galaxy bispectrum of logical structure, just in its kind of a simple form. The actual form, even at lowest order, the actual galaxy bispectrum is very complicated. There's a 52-page paper on it by Misha Ivanov and myself, came out quite recently. But the salient points here is the dependence on three different types of physics. So the first one is these guys in red. So these are the galaxy bias parameters. So effectively, this is telling us about galaxy formation physics. So for example, B1 says, How does the galaxy density respond to the matter density? BS2 here says, how does the galaxy density respond to tidal fields in the universe? So that's interesting. If we detect that's non-zero, we learn something about tidal physics and galaxy formation. But of course, that's not the only thing. The second thing here is this F2 guy here. So this is basically encoding the physics of gravity. So if we had modified general relativity, it would generically show up in this guy here, which just comes from a kind of Euler and Poisson gravitational fluid equations. And of course, the third thing then is the power spectra here. And these are important simply because they encode early universe cosmology and that whole sort of raft of interesting things I showed you in the linear power spectrum before. So then, of course, from the galaxy bispectrum, we can measure these early universe things. But if we wanted to measure all of the information about the early universe, or not just early, but also late universe, we can't just use this bispectrum. Yes, the bispectrum depends on the early universe through this linear power spectrum, but so do other statistics. So if we want to get all the possible information, we're going to need to start with the power spectrum and then add the bispectrum and then add the trispectrum and just keep going. Now, on the large scales, we have a relatively nice regime. And it's the case that the power spectrum contains most of the information. The bispectrum is suppressed by an extra factor of P linear here. The trispectrum is further suppressed, etc. And that basically means that when we add in the bispectrum, we're only going to add a little bit more information about standard lambda CDM. Of course, if we were to go down to small scales, this hierarchy completely breaks down and changes. And the bispectrum becomes more important than your power spectrum, etc. And in this case, we probably shouldn't be using endpoint functions anyway, because we're really outside the perturbative regime. So having said all this about bispectrum, why they're fun, it's worth me saying a little bit about what we currently do. So this on the right is a plot of the galaxy power spectrum from the BOSS survey. I'm just showing you one of the key components here, galaxy monopole. And the kind of state of the art is to measure this galaxy power spectrum and do a scaling analysis for it. So what I mean by a scaling analysis is we basically rescale this guy to measure the overall amplitude, which basically tells us F sigma 8, and the overall, and the wavelength of the oscillatory features. So these oscillatory features are just baryon acoustic oscillations. So we have a nice 3-parameter characterization of this. It's straightforward. And it's been showing that it's a very robust way to constrain things like the growth rate of cosmic structure and also the expansion history. So to give you an idea of what that looks like, this is a plot of the growth rate, the expansion history as a function of time. So basically I'm plotting this Hubble expansion rate as a function of redshift from redshift 0 today up to redshift 3. And the colored points are what we get from current data. So you can see, say, the BOSS galaxies in red here give us constraints on this expansion rate at relatively low redshifts. And as we move into the era of DESI, Euclid, and other experiments, spherics, et cetera, we're going to start getting many, many more data points here. And those are shown in sort of gray and black here for DESI. And you can see we get to measure this expansion history across a really decent sampling in redshift. And that's very interesting if you want to probe things like dark energy models, stuff like that. So this is all very nice. But a question that has been asked recently is, well, what else can we do with this power spectrum? We've got power spectrum measured to exquisite precision. Can we get more information from them than simply these couple of scaling parameters? So the answer is yes. So a couple of groups have been looking at this, in particular, Leonardo Sanatori's and Matthias Arriaga's, also recently Martin White's, with the idea of, let's take the galaxy power spectrum and actually try and measure all of cosmology directly from it. So this is just the same as is done for the CMB power spectrum. They don't bother with scaling parameters. They measure everything directly. And the idea is kind of shown in the schematic on the right. So for example, we're measuring the dark matter fraction via the amplitude of these wiggles, measuring the neutrino mass via suppression at high K. We're measuring primordial slopes, primordial amplitudes, et cetera, et cetera. So this is nice. It's been shown that we can do it for current data. So to give you an idea of how well this works, this is a plot of some constraints on key parameters from the BOSS galaxy survey, so just the power spectrum, against those from Planck. And you can see that in general, the constraints are somewhat weaker than the CMB, but for some parameters, we're actually getting of a similar order. For example, H0 now, I think this was a 1.6% constraint on H0. And I think current data, some of the new analysis we're doing actually managed to get this even tighter still. So we're now already competitive with the CMB. And it turns out these sorts of analyses can actually measure some interesting new things. So for example, when I showed you the power spectrum earlier, I showed you that you can measure H0 not just from these wiggly features, which are picked up by the standard boss-like analyses, but also the position of this matter radiation equality scale, and in particular, real broadband shape of the power spectrum. Now, it's recently been shown that you can measure this directly from your galaxy power spectra, which hasn't been done before. And in fact, in the era of Euclid or DESI, this becomes very interesting. So I think we were doing a recent forecast led by Garrett Farron, a grad student in Cambridge, which hopefully should be out in the next week or two, which actually shows that the constraints on Hubble parameter from matter radiation equality are actually only 40% or so weaker than those from the sound horizon in the next generation of surveys. So it becomes quite a nice consistency test, things like new physics in the early universe.
So this is can I ask? So these papers are all pretty recent, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So how come people didn't do this before?
It's a great question. So one of the difficulties is that this is a lot more difficult than the CMB in terms of a modeling perspective. So we need a theory model which is accurate and able to, we need a theory model which is accurate and also fast to compute. So if we want to do an MCMC analysis, we're probably going to need to sample the power spectrum, say 10 to the 5 times. And in fact, there were only efficient ways of computing the relevant loop integrals, I think a couple of years ago. It's mostly based on so-called the FFT log algorithm, which I think comes back from about, it's used in cosmology, stems back from about 2017. So mostly just computational considerations. This couldn't be done previously. Also, modeling as well has advanced quite a lot recently.
So it's because you're pushing to higher K, I guess, in some sense than the BAO was?
Yeah, so like you could use very, very large scales only. And in that case, you could model just with a linear power spectrum, which is fast. But you are limited to not very many modes in that regime right here. So that would limit you probably K of 0.07 or so. Right here, we're going to K of 0.2 or 0.3. And for that, you really need all the loop integral corrections, which to compute them brute force is actually, it takes kind of hours, and you can't do that hundreds of thousands of times.
Sure. All right, thanks.
Okay, great.
So can I follow up on that? So these various groups, are there constraints that they're getting consistent with each other?
That's a good question. So one of the things that was nice recently is the two kind of main groups did a blind test on simulations, where effectively they were both given n-body power spectra from an n-body simulation and asked to identify the cosmological parameters without knowing the truth. And in that case, both of the two main groups got exactly the same thing, which was great. So they both passed the test. Right now, the constraints are broadly consistent on real data. There's always, every now and then, there's some slight differences depending on exactly what you put priors on, what parameters you sample, whether you use AS or log AS, et cetera. But in general, they're pretty consistent. That's true.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Okay. So having said that we can do all this, one of the interesting questions now has become, what more can we do? So for the BOSS power spectra, we're pretty much shot noise dominated now. Like, we can't really push to much smaller scales simply because we are just noise dominated. That will slightly change with DESI. We'll be able to use slightly smaller scale information. Probably need slightly better modeling to include that. But right now, if we want to get any more information, we need something beyond the power spectrum. So the natural thing to do then is to try and do this for the bispectrum. So the real reason behind this is that if we use the bispectrum, we get sharper constraints on cosmological parameters. So to give you an idea of this, this is a forecast for Euclid, and in particular the spectroscopic galaxy sample. So it'll be probably pretty similar for DESI. And what you see on the right here is the constraint on the neutrino mass from the power spectrum in yellow, and that with the bispectrum in blue. And effectively, you can see that the constraints improve by a factor roughly of the order of 30 to 40% here. And you get a decent constraint, especially when you add in Planck. It's likely that we could constrain the minimal neutrino mass at a few sigma level, hopefully. So, of course, the bispectrum is very important for this. But of course, it's non-trivial to add it into the analysis pipelines. If it was trivial, exactly as Neil was just saying, it would probably already have been done. So I missed that one, I think. But so before I talk about a little bit more of how we do this bispectrum in practice, I just want to mention a couple of other motivations for why, from my point of view, it's actually interesting. And these really focus on really the non-Lambda CDM universe. So whether we can learn extra things about, say, the physics of inflation from using these sorts of higher order statistics. So of course, one of the key questions of early universe cosmology is, do we actually have Gaussianity in the initial conditions? So that nice kind of delta going as normal distribution, does that actually hold? So of course, we're going to need to think about inflation for this. So a standard model of inflation is just a nice scalar field phi, a potential. It's got some action. So this is just encoding really all the physics in our simplest models. We have the physics of gravity in the Ricci scalar. We have the kinetic energy of the field. And we have the potential energy of the field. And this is nice because it just tells us about the statistics of the primordial curvature and therefore also the primordial density fluctuations, just gauge transforming. So if we take this action, we expand it, what it tells us is the power spectrum of the initial universe looks roughly like a power law. This is no surprise because we sort of really only allow potentials that give us exactly this slope to be consistent with the single field slow roll conditions. But what it also tells us is that at next to leading order, even your simplest model of inflation I've given you there generically produces some kind of bispectrum. So this is a particular non-Gaussianity in the early universe, and it's proportional to this F and L guy here. So this is primordial non-Gaussianity, and it might seem like I've sort of led to a logical inconsistency here, because I started off by saying the universe is very Gaussian, and now I said that the early universe is non-Gaussian. So of course, what comes into play is this well-known consistency condition, which is simply that the large-scale bispectrum is actually very, very much suppressed for single-field models. So although we generically do produce some non-Gaussianity in the very early universe, the level is very, very small in our simplest models. But then if we did want to actually generate some detectable non-Gaussianity in the early universe, there are things we could do to our model to generate this. So for example, if we had multiple fields in inflation, this would generate a bispectrum in the very early universe, and in particular this bispectrum of the form shown at the top. But also if we did other things, like had a different kinetic term instead of this d mu phi squared here, we could have, say, dBi inflation. That would lead to a different form of bispectrum in the early universe, or a different vacuum state in the early universe. And the point of this is all these give us different primordial bispectra. And if we have a primordial bispectrum, it's going to give us a signal in the bispectrum of observables today. So of course, the question then is, how do we measure it? Well, the simplest thing is just to look at the CMB. So the CMB temperature bispectrum, for example, that's shown in this strange tetrahedral plot over on the right. Bispectra are difficult to plot because they're in three dimensions. So effectively, what can and what has been done by Planck is to take these measurements, also polarization as well, and simply try and search for the signatures of each type of non-Gaussianity within this data set. And that gives us pretty strong constraints. So for example, the local type from multiple fields is constrained to within plus or minus six or so. And it's going to get slightly better in the future. CMB stage four, we're forecasting roughly 2 times better constraints, but not huge improvements, mostly because the volume of sky we have access to is limited. We can only ever observe 4 pi steradians of the CMB. So this is kind of the canonical way to measure this, but it's not the only way. So another alternative is to measure things from the galaxy power spectrum. So at first sight, that might seem strange because we're measuring non-Gaussianity. How can we measure that from a power spectrum? So it turns out there's this nice relation of galaxy bias and primordial non-Gaussianity. So effectively, if you have non-Gaussianity in your universe, galaxies become more biased than you would expect. So this curve on the red line here, this red curves here, is showing you the change in galaxy bias as a function of scale if you have local type primordial non-Gaussianity. And the important point is that on large scales, we get an order one correction to the galaxy bias. And you can really search for this. You simply look at your sample and say, does my bias contain a piece which goes as 1 over k squared? And this has been done. you get constraints from things like quasars in particular. Right now, the constraints are plus or minus 20 or so, plus or minus 30 perhaps. So they're still a little bit weaker than the CMB, but they're getting stronger and stronger. With something like DESI, they'll get much stronger still. But however, this isn't a perfect constraint, because this will tell you about things like this local type non-Gaussianity. But if you're interested in things like the equilateral type one, which is this curve shown in pink here, this actually isn't very useful, because the bias doesn't really change when we add in non-Gaussianity. It doesn't change in a scale-dependent way, which is the real thing we're interested in. So if we want to measure something like equilateral type non-Gaussianity from large-scale structure, we need to use a full-on bispectrum. So we can, in fact, do this. What we do is, just like the CMB, we measure the full bispectrum of our galaxy survey, and then try and fit models for, say, the equilateral type non-Gaussianity. It turns out this is somewhat more difficult than the CMB. And the real limitation here is that the bispectrum has a very large signal just from lambda CDM. So this is just the gravitational bispectrum I was mentioning before, which for the purpose of measuring FNL is really just a contaminant. So we need to try and look for a primordial signal within this complicated mess of bispectrum signal from gravity here. But at least it can, in principle, be done. And this is something that in the IS we're looking at right now, is how can we actually get constraints on the bispectra, on FNL from our bispectra directly. So having said that about FNL, I just want to mention one slightly more esoteric model of the early universe, which actually motivates why we need a different type of higher order statistic. So in this case, I'm going to think about an early universe physics involving not just one field, not just our single inflaton phi, but also some kind of gauge field, a vector field, if you prefer. So we have a new action, which has an additional coupling set. This F mu nu is just a nice electromagnetic tensor involving the gauge field. And this couples to our scalar field phi. Now, what's important actually for this purpose is the second term here. So this is known as the Chern-Simons coupling, after Jim Simons. And we get a coupling between a pseudoscalar here and also this second F with a tilde on it. So this is technically a Hodge dual. This is not entirely esoteric. It's actually was shown, it's a nice paper by Stefan Alexander about a decade ago, to show that this sort of coupling can actually lead to barrier genesis and give us the formation of matter over antimatter. But the thing that's actually interesting for this discussion is that this term violates parity symmetry. So what do I mean by that? Well, I mean that if we take the universe and simply reflect it in the mirror, If I take the universe and reflect it in a mirror, what I'm doing is a parity transformation. And we normally expect that that sort of operation is going to leave the universe looking pretty much similar to how it normally looks on very large scales. But if I take this term here and reflect it in a mirror, it's going to change sign. And that's interesting, because if we have this parity violating thing in the primordial action here, it's going to generate a piece of correlators in the early universe and in the late universe, which have this same parity violating form. So the question then is, how can we look for this? How can we test parity violation in the universe today? So of course, the simplest thing we could do is look at, say, the two-point function or the power spectrum. So what I'm showing you on the left is the two-point function, and on the right, the same thing after a parity transformation. You see it simply just flips the guy around. Now, the difficulty here is that these two functions are in fact just related by a rotation. And we're pretty sure the universe is rotationally symmetric. And that means that any information we might have had about parity between the difference of the left and the right here is washed out by a rotational symmetry. So this guy can't tell us anything about parity transformations. So we could then say, well, let's look at the three-point function. We've now got a triplet of particles, or we could have used a bispectrum, but the same thing. And again, we take our shape and we do a parity transformation. Once again, these two are simply related by a rotation. You can just flip the triangle out of the page and back in again. That's a perfectly valid rotation in 3D. And it means that statistically, the left and the right side must be exactly the same. So we can't learn anything about parity from the three-point function. So of course, the next thing we can do is go to the four-point function. So now we have a tetrahedron of points. And now we should really imagine here, these are not coplanar. They're just quite difficult to draw. And an important thing here is that the tetrahedron on the left and the tetrahedron on the right are not related by any spatial rotation. So statistically speaking, these two guys are different. Of course, assuming the axis lengths are different. And what this means is that if we measure the four-point function from tetrahedra shown on the left and subtract off the four-point function from tetrahedron shown on the right, it will only be non-zero if the universe conserves parity. So the difference of these two is a sensitive probe of parity violation within large-scale structure. So this is particularly interesting because in galaxy survey contexts, this needs the four-point function. You cannot do this with any kind of lower order statistic. So at this point, I come back to my earlier question of why we're interested in all this stuff. And I say it's not just a case of getting stronger constraints on lambda CDM. It's also a case of testing non-standard physics models. And logical structure is actually quite a nice way in which to do this. And one of the features of that is that it's a three-dimensional observable. So the signal to noise is technically cubic in the number of modes we observe, whereas the CMB is pretty much a two-dimensional observable, so it tends to be quadratic. And also, we've only so far observed a very small amount of the universe. We can keep observing more and more volume, unlike the CMB, which means that even though the constraints right now are pretty weak, they're going to get stronger and stronger. And if we're interested in constraints on new physics, we can also work at pretty high redshift. So if we're interested in, say, I don't know, the neutrino mass from the galaxy bispectrum, that's actually only really useful at low redshift, because at high redshift, the lambda CDM bispectrum kind of goes to zero. But if we're interested in, say, primordial non-Gaussianity or these parity-violating models, we can see these signatures just as well at redshift 3 as we can at redshift 0. So that's actually going to be particularly interesting kind of in the next generation of surveys, things like MegaMapper, if they happen, and kind of 21 centimeters. As we're getting to very, very high volumes, we can actually do pretty well on all these sorts of non-lambda CDM physics. Okay, so at this point, I hope I've convinced you that all this is actually has some use. So now let me tell you a little bit more about why this is hard. So in order to think about this, I want to say a little bit about how we actually go about measuring a bispectrum in practice. So the bispectrum is simply just three density fields with some Dirac function. So this integral up here is not too difficult to do. You can do some Fourier transforms, do some exponentials, rewrite some things as integrals, not too bad. The difficulty, however, is we don't have access to the true density field of our survey. In practice, we measure the density field multiplied by some mask. I've called it W here. So what this looks like is a function like the guy on the right. So effectively, there's some regions of the sky which we can observe and there's some regions we can't. So if we have a bright star in front of our galaxy, we're not going to be able to see the galaxy. That actually gives you these streaky patterns you can see moving away from our telescope here. And of course, then there's regions of sky that we observe for longer and less time, et cetera. And it gives us a pretty complicated function, which is multiplying the true density distribution of the galaxies. Multiplications are fine, but in Fourier space, it's a convolution. And the bispectrum itself is actually a triple convolution of the true bispectrum with our window functions, or with our masks here. So if we want to make use of a bispectrum and do a full-on bispectrum analysis, we're going to need to take our theory model for the bispectrum and do exactly the same operation to it as is being done on the data. So we're going to need to perform this triple window convolution integral on our theory model. So this is just this integral written on the top. It's a six-dimensional oscillatory integral. And the problem is it's too costly to do repeatedly. Like I can do this one time, it takes a couple of hours, no problem. But if you want to do an MCMC, if you want to do a full-on bispectrum analysis, we need to keep doing this many times. And that's just very expensive. So for this reason, the kind of only large-scale structure bispectrum analyses to date have made do with some interesting assumptions to get around this. So for one, they take the bispectrum and say, the bispectrum is roughly two power spectra in lambda CDM, plus a couple of extra terms and numerical factors, et cetera. So why don't we take these power spectra and apply the window only to the power spectrum? So we'll use up two windows windowing the first power spectra and two windows windowing the second power spectra. So in total, we've used up four windows to do this. But if you notice the integral at the top, we only had three windows. So somehow doing this approximate treatment, we've gained an extra window function. And secondly, it's also just entirely wrong. Like the bispectrum takes a more complicated form than this. There's extra facts of K1 and K2 floating around. And additionally, we've got all of these Dirac functions basically implicitly in here. And as such, this guy will lead to systematic errors. Now, this is not a new point. This was known. In fact, in the previous FOSS bispectrum analyses, they had to throw out all of the large scale modes and really any bispectrum triangle with a large scale mode, simply because this gave us undue systematic errors. And the problem is that the large modes are also some of the most interesting ones. Like if we want to measure, say, equilateral non-Gaussianity, we really care about the largest modes in our survey because they don't have contributions from lambda CDM. So if we simply do this, we can't use our spectra to search for any new physics models. Indeed, even lambda CDM constraints will get significantly worse. So if we want to make use of the bispectra, we're going to need a slightly smarter approach. And that's something I've been thinking about recently. And effectively, the reasoning we've been coming up with is to say, well, the problem is that we have all this window convolution integral. That's what's being difficult. Imagine instead of measuring this horrible windowed bispectrum, could we measure the true underlying bispectrum itself? So could we measure the thing before it's been convolved with all this stuff? If we could do that, we could simply compare it to the theory model without having to do these integrals. It'd be a much simpler, much less computationally expensive procedure. So that's exactly what we've been trying to do. So effectively, we take our density field and we take an estimate of the mask and we combine them both together and get then an estimate of the true unconvolved window function. So in truth, this is really just deconvolution, but it's a deconvolution done in a relatively principled way. So in fact, what we're doing here is we first of all take the likelihood for our entire galaxy survey. So this has a nice analytic form on large scales. And we take that likelihood and we maximize it with respect to the true underlying bispectrum we actually want to measure. And when we do this, it gives us an estimator for what the bispectrum looks like. That sounds like a relatively simple procedure. It can be done analytically. Effectively, what it does is it gives us a maximum likelihood approach, which deconvolves the window in a minimum variance manner. And in fact, it actually works surprisingly well. So let me just give you a couple more indications to how this actually works in practice. We write down a likelihood for an entire galaxy survey at a pixel level. This is a light Gaussian piece, plus then there's non-Gaussian contributions. So there's Edgeworth expansion here. It's pretty complicated. It involves the covariance of every pixel in our survey with every other pixel, which is this thing shown in maroon. So if you had a million pixels, this would be a million by million matrix. And it also involves the three-point version of that. So the average of every first, second, and third pixel. So a million by a million by a million function. So effectively, you can write that likelihood down and you can do all the optimization analytically. And effectively, what you're going to end up with is a cubic estimator. So this says, take three copies of your data, these things I'm circling here, and multiply them all together with some filter. And this is going to give you an estimate for the bispectrum. There's also an extra matrix bit here, which works out to do all the messy deconvolution for you. And one of the important things is it involves the data multiplied by the inverse of this covariance. So that's the inverse of the covariance of every pixel in our survey with every other pixel in our survey. So that's actually a kind of high dimensional object. Like it's a million by a million matrix, which we have to invert. So of course that's beyond the realm of most of standard computational procedures. So we need to use tricks. So thankfully, a lot of these things have already been worked out. A lot of these approaches were really just stealing from CMB analyses of the late 1990s. And so for example, this C inverse of the data, we can do perturbatively. So we do something called conjugate gradient descent. So effectively you start off with a guess of what your matrix should be, and then you just basically keep improving your guess. And as you can see here, it actually converges to the truth very, very quickly. So this is just after like 10 iterations, we get a good estimate of the inverse of the covariance times by our data. So this can be done pretty quickly. It's just a load of Fourier transforms. So putting this stuff all together, what we get is we get an estimator for the bispectrum, which is formally unbiased, minimum variance, and window free. So on the right-hand side here, I'm showing a picture of this bispectrum itself. So the points here are the actual true underlying bispectra, and the lines are what we get from our window for when we apply the window to this. So you can basically see there's a big difference between the windowed and the unwindowed bispectra, simply showing that survey geometry is important on large scales and is killing a lot of our power. So this has now all been implemented with all these techniques and tricks I just talked about. And we're actually now at the point we can actually go ahead and apply it to actual data and create true bispectrum measurements, which we can then just compare to our theory model. So this is actually a plot of this. So on the bottom panel here, I'm showing you estimates of the bispectra using all these window-free techniques. And in the top, I'm actually showing you exactly the same just for the power spectrum. Again, using the window-free things. And one of the interesting works I've been thinking about right now with Misha Ivanov, upstairs in the IES, is basically to say, let's take the power spectrum, let's take the bispectrum, and let's try and do the most complete and full shape analysis of BOSS survey data today. So we're going to use all of our knowledge we have of the power spectrum, reconstructed power spectrum modeling, and add in bispectrum modeling with a theory model. So this theory model has now been tested on simulations bigger than the whole observable universe, and it works. So put all these things together and get constraints on cosmological parameters. So this is the first time it's been done sort of properly without having to make all these systematic inducing approximations and also get rid of a lot of the large scale data. So we're really including all the large scale data here. We're still on relatively large scales of the bispectrum, so we don't include much small scale data. That's something that we're looking to change a little bit in the future as we get better and better modeling. So I can give you an indication of what we actually expect to measure. So the paper on this hopefully will be out in the next week, I would hope. So in terms of cosmology, the main thing we get is the sigma 8 parameter improves by about 10%. So it's not a huge improvement. I think 13% would be more accurate here, but it certainly is an improvement. That's equivalent to the BOSS survey having an additional 20% of the observing time, or for DESI, sort of almost an extra year of DESI. And in fact, as we push the modeling further and add extra information like the redshift space, extra components of the bispectrum, this will probably increase quite a bit. And if we're interested in things like bias parameters and like tidal physics, those sorts of galaxy bias actually improve by quite a significant extent. Tidal bias improves by roughly 50%. And there's an extra sort of higher order piece, which improves by a factor of 2 to 3. Of course, we can do not just lambda CDM, we can also do all other flavors of primordial, all flavors of primordial non-Gaussianity. So this result will not come out next week. It's still very much preliminary, but hopefully it comes out in the spring. We'll get constraints on, say, the equilateral type non-Gaussianity, which I think are the first time this has been measured from large scale structure itself. Right now, they're still weak. They're about 7 times weaker than Planck. But in the era of DESI, we're hoping that these will get quite considerably stronger. In fact, by the end of DESI and Euclid, primordial non-Gaussianity will be roughly the same as the CMB. Beyond that still, we'll get much better still. So this is interesting, and it really motivates us, hopefully, to sort of take these methods and really streamline them further and see how we can extract even more information from them in the future. So having said all this in the bispectra, I actually wanted to give you one other interesting flavor, which is some ideas about how we do similar things for correlation functions. So in this case, we're thinking in configuration space rather than Fourier space. And it turns out in this sense, we have quite a different suite of problems we have to worry about. So if we think about, say, the four-point function, one question we have is how do we measure it? So the four-point function is an average of 4 galaxy density fields, the 4 delta g's here. And the simple way we have to measure the four-point function simply involves counting up quadruplets of galaxies. So I pick 4 galaxies at random, or say deterministically, I pick my first 4 galaxies and I form a tetrahedron from them. And this tetrahedron has some distribution of side lengths, R1, R2, and R3, and some internal angles. Once I've done that, I then take another tetrahedron and I see what the side lengths of this are and the angles. And then I take another tetrahedron. And in this manner, I iterate over the entire galaxy survey, looking at every possible quadruplet of galaxies, every possible tetrahedron they form. So the total number of tetrahedra is of the order of the number of galaxies to the 4th power. So if we have a million galaxies, this is a million to the four. And the problem is that this is way too many to count. So if we want just a simple, naive estimate of the four-point function, we need to estimate, we need to count 10 to the 24 tetrahedra, which we simply can't do. And it's in fact for this reason that the four-point function has never been used in a cosmological analysis. So if we want to actually make some use of it and do things like testing this parity-violating physics and Chern-Simons term I was talking about, we're going to need a smarter approach. That's again something I've been thinking about. And it's the core of this idea is thinking of a more efficient way to represent a tetrahedron. So a tetrahedron here is three vectors, or three sides and three angles. And one thing I could equivalently write this as is an outer product of three different vectors. So once I fix the bottom galaxy here, we've got a vector to the top one, vector to the left one, and a vector to the right one. And of course, this is purely equivalent. I've just blown up my tetrahedron. But this is actually quite an important step. And the reason is that on the left, let's say I picked a bottom galaxy and fixed that one, and then I wanted to compute all possible tetrahedra given that bottom one. I'd have to count n cubed particles because I've got three choices of these higher vertices. But on the right, effectively what I'm saying is I can compute this as an outer product. So I compute every possible blue vector, every possible red vector, every possible green vector, and I simply take the outer product. And that's just going to be order n, because I've only got to somewhere over one secondary galaxy once I've specified the bottom one. So this can be done. Effectively, we just need to count up pairs of galaxies given a length and an angle. It turns out angles are kind of clunky to work with. If you get into discretization problems, stuff like that. So what's much nicer is to do everything in spherical harmonics. So any angle can always be written as a sum of spherical harmonics. And in this case, our tetrahedron is now specified by three lengths and three spherical harmonic multiples here, these L's here. So effectively what we do is to compute this tetrahedron, we sum over pairs of galaxies weighted by a spherical harmonic. So to say this a little bit more rigorously, what's actually going on is we're taking our four-point function here and we're decomposing this into a radial piece and an angular piece. And the angular piece is simply a product of three spherical harmonics. So it's a spherical harmonic in this R1 vector here, in the R2 vector, and the R3 vector here. This basis is entirely general. The only thing it assumes here is that the four-point function is isotropic, so it has full rotational symmetry. We can go beyond that, so I can say about that in a minute. But effectively, the use of this comes directly from the separability. There's also this Wigner 3J symbol here. That just comes from some angular momentum considerations, which is really how this basis function is derived. So I'm going to show you a painful equation to show you how we actually estimate this in practice. This is the painful equation on the top. Effectively, what you can see is we have our four density fields here, but now they're written in a much nicer form. So we have a blue, a red, and a green part of this equation, and all three of these can be estimated separately. And this means we never need to consider all four of our galaxies at once. So in fact, how we actually do this is we sit on one galaxy, sit on this bottom galaxy here, and we sum up every single secondary galaxy weighted by a spherical harmonic. And that's going to give us every possible choice, every possible value for this blue bracket here and the red bracket and the green bracket. And then we just add them all together. And then we choose another bottom galaxy and we do the same thing. And the point of this is that we in total generate n squared galaxies rather than n to the four, which can be computed very, very efficiently. It's much, so we can compute this guy, say for current data, in roughly 10 hours, which is much better than the standard approach, which would take roughly the age of the universe. So we have code that does this. It's called ENCORE, which is a somewhat dodgy acronym, Efficient Endpoint Correlation Estimator. And one of the nice things about doing this in real space is that you can actually correct quite nicely for the effects of survey geometry, because your mask is just multiplication rather than a convolution. We can effectively just divide this out. So this works. It computes the four-point function, and it also computes all sorts of other higher point functions you fancy. And in fact, it actually can work in much more general scenarios still. So this is
the slide. Can I ask something? Do redshift space distortions cause a problem for you? I mean, like it sounded like you had to assume isotropy. Yep. I mean, well, it sounded like you had to assume statistical isotropy, but then RSD will, well, they break isotropy, right? So, so how do you deal with that?
Great question. So the scenario I've just been describing is how to measure the angle averaged four-point function. So I'm effectively just measuring it averaged over all possible orientations of your tetrahedra. Mm-hmm. And in that case, that's an isotropic function. So you can represent that with the basis of isotropic functions. But the point of redshift space distortions is that that isn't all of the information there is. Like there mm-hmm. is also information. We could also say, expand the orientation of this tetrahedron with respect to the redshift space axis. And in this case, it's just going to give you an additional set of components. So we're going to get, say, like a Legendre series with respect to that line of sight. And in fact, we can account for those too. So as on the next slide, we can actually measure all these anisotropic correlation functions. Effectively, we actually do exactly the same algorithm. You just add the spherical harmonics up in a slightly different way. And you then get your, say, four-point function as a spherical harmonic, as a Legendre series with respect to the redshift space axis as well. So it will quite significantly increase the number of components you have, but it's possible to do this in full generality. Assuming that I think there is some subtle assumption that the underlying metric has to be isotropic, but that's less relevant here. The statistic doesn't have to be, just you said. Yeah, and it's worth saying we can also do other things like five-point functions. This is just a sum over four spherical harmonics, six-point functions or a sum over five spherical harmonics, etc. Or we can also do even more fun things, like if your universe isn't flat, this still works, it turns out. You can have hyperbolic universes or curved universes. My personal favorite thing, you can do this in different numbers of dimensions. So if you wanted to compute a six-point function on the surface of a four-dimensional hyperboloid, you can do it. Effectively, you do exactly the same procedure. You just have to start worrying about spherical harmonics in different numbers of dimensions. So spherical harmonics are basically telling you about rotation algebra in three dimensions, which is really just telling about angular momenta. You can do the same calculation in a different number of dimensions. And it's all just related to Lie algebras and SOD group theory, which is a lot of fun. If anyone thinks of an example of a four-dimensional correlation function, the referee would be very happy to hear one. He wasn't very happy with my entirely theoretical paper. But anyway, also there is a, if anyone wants to play around with this, there's code that computes these endpoint functions in pretty much any two, three, and four dimensions on spheres and Euclidean geometries, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very interesting mathematical problem, aside from whether it has any physical use. The two-dimensional case is possibly interesting because you can do things like these sorts of basis work on the surface of spheres, which is, of course, a two-dimensional curved surface. Okay, so going back to cosmology, so for the last...
say one thing. I mean, so one thing people do like to do is, you know, in gauge gravity duality, they like to calculate the correlation function of a theory in the hyperbolic space, okay. In the bulk, and then the corresponding correlation function on the theory on the boundary, which could be on a spherical or flat boundary, and compare them. And that can happen in all sorts of different dimensions. So anyway, just one
that sounds like an interesting application. Okay, I should look more into that. Thank you very much. Okay, so for the last kind of 5 minutes or so, I just wanted to say a couple of things about actually how this works, like real data. So one thing question we wanted to ask is, can we actually detect this signal in practice? So we said, let's take say a million galaxies, the best current data set we have publicly, and try and compute the four-point correlation function. Now, there's a slight subtlety with this, is that the true four-point function contains two pieces. It contains a piece going as the two-point function squared, or the power spectrum squared, and it contains a new piece, which is all of the non-Gaussianity. We really only care about the second piece. The first piece, two-point function squared, that's entirely degenerate with a two-point function, so we don't care about it. So we always subtract that off. So whenever I say four-point function here, I really mean the non-Gaussian piece of the four-point function. And that's the interesting bit, which hasn't been looked at before. So this is a plot of the four-point function of real data. Now, it's a little bit of a messy plot. These things are incredibly difficult to plot because they're in six dimensions. So what I'm showing is one of the components of the four-point function. There's a whole host of spherical harmonic components. This is just one of them. And as I go from left to right here, I go from small to large scales, both from data and simulations. And the salient point here is that as we go to small scales here, you can see that these points diverge away from zero. And that's interesting because it's suggesting we are actually detecting something from current data. So of course, we can try and quantify how to do this and how well it actually works. So the simplest thing we can do is do a chi-squared test. Chi-squared tests are lovely if your likelihood is Gaussian. If your likelihood is non-Gaussian, you possibly stop. You probably should worry a little bit more because chi-squared tests might not apply. But at this point, this level, we'll just consider it to be roughly Gaussian, and we'll do a standard chi-squared test, assuming that we don't detect anything. This is the expected distribution we want here. And this is what we get from real data. So current BOSS data, we expect we can detect this four-point function non-Gaussianity at roughly 8 sigma. Now, this is not a detection of primordial non-Gaussianity, sadly. This is most likely just a detection of standard gravitational physics. So we're really probably just learning stuff about lambda CDM from this. But that's interesting. So the question then is, well, if we can detect this, and in current data we're going to detect it somewhat better, 15 sigma or so, what can we do with it? So one thing we can do is to learn things about lambda CDM. So let's say we have a theory model. We can then quantify how much information is there, and then extract the information. So we maybe get a better constraint on sigma 8 or the Hubble parameter. So this is nice. It can be done. But I should warn you that, in fact, the amount of information about lambda CDM in these functions isn't going to be huge. And the reason for that is because on the scales of which we understand this, on sort of perturbative scales, we have this hierarchy of power spectra, bispectra, trispectra. So the trispectra, or the four-point function, only adds a little bit more information. Of course, we could go to smaller scales, we could get a lot more information, but that would require a lot more, that would require numerical modeling, and then we stopped having to worry about things like baryonic effects and hydrodynamical stuff.
Hi, Oliver, can I ask you a question regarding the theory? And so you mentioned, I assume in the Lagrangian that you showed before, that was the inflaton, the phi. You're assuming that was the inflaton field. So would you have a four-point function without having a signal in the three-point function?
That's an interesting question. I think yes. The answer, I think, can be yes. Depending on how you do it. So, for example, that that like parity violating example would exactly give you that. That gives you only a 4-point function without a 3-point function.
Why? I mean, it's an interaction. So why doesn't it give you interactions at the 3-point level?
Sorry, that's a good point. Ah, no, I was getting that confused. Yes, it also generates an FNL. Good point. Okay.
What types of physics would you see that you wouldn't see given at the 3-point functions, not as already constrained?
Yeah, so there are some interesting ones. And I think actually this kind of Chern-Simons one is actually quite interesting because if it gives you a 3-point signal, it's primarily just going to look something like FNL. And in fact, it's actually quite difficult to search for something like that in the galaxy function just because we have all sorts of other mess in there. We have to deal with gravitational physics, et cetera. Like the nice thing about this 4-point function is you can look just at the parity violating piece, and that parity violating piece should have no signal from conventional physics. The only signal can come from any parity violating observables. So it's from large scale structure point of view, a component of the 4-point function is a much cleaner probe than the 3-point function.
So you will be more so there is no systematic, there's nothing that will contaminate it even statistically.
Of course, systematics are always there. They're always the difficulty. If you were to think, if ignore the effects of telescopes and stuff like that and how we observe them, anything happening from the physics of gravity should be parity conserving. Really, no large scale physics should generate this apart from kind of very interesting like weak interactions or something, which maybe magnetic fields, but they should all be on pretty small scales. So it's really the case that this signal should be zero unless we have something very interesting in the early universe. Of course, you do have to worry about how your telescope characterizes things and window functions and masks, etc. But assuming that we were able to understand those, you can do it.
Do you have any, I guess what I'm asking is a more quantitative question. Do you have any idea how much the coupling that you write down is already constrained from the three points, so that, or how well you can do in the first point?
Yeah, so quantitatively, this actually is interesting. So there's a paper by Matsuyoshi Shiraishi in 2016. Looking at that for the CMB case. And it turns out in that case, it was looking at the contributions to the 2, the 3, and the 4-point function. And interestingly, the 4-point function is actually the most discriminatory.
I see. Now, okay.
I would have to look into the exact details of it.
By
several orders of magnitude, actually.
Interesting. So this is the paper by whom?
It's Matsuyoshi Shiraishi.
How do I spell it?
I've written it down somewhere. Okay, I can find it later.
Later. Continue with your talk. Thank you.
Cool. So this parity violating thing is an interesting scenario then, just because we can actually just look for something entirely different in galaxies. And we can actually do a relatively nice blind test for it. So you simply look at, say, the 4-point function, and you say, do I detect any parity violating signal, like coming from any type of early universe physics we could think of? This can be done. Like, you have to be slightly careful how you characterize noise in this, because of course noise fluctuations this signal will be non-zero from noise, but on average it should be zero, apart from interesting physics. So that's actually this kind of active project I've been involved with, is trying to trying to do a test from large scale structure alone to test sort of parity violation in the universe. In fact, the approach I'm doing is very much simulation based. So we say, this guy is probably not Gaussian distributed, so we probably can't use a chi-squared test. So what I'm actually going to do is measure the statistics from a bunch of realistic simulations and compare the data to the distribution you get from those simulations and actually see, do we detect anything unusual? And in fact, you can actually say that if you assumed everything to be Gaussian, you would actually get completely the wrong answer. You detect something when there wasn't anything there. So of course, the other application of these guys is we can apply them to actual data with the CMB, et cetera, and do interesting things with them. So as an example, actually this on the bottom here is the 4-point function we'd get from this Chern-Simons model. It's somewhat difficult to do the theory models. You have to start at very early universe. You have to evolve them to redshift zero, or galaxy redshifts, add galaxy bias, redshift space distortions, convert them into real space, et cetera, but it can at least be done. This is a real calculation. I should say the amplitude of this is arbitrary. The error bars are real, but this is just an indication of the sort of signal we can search for in the data. That's another thing I've been interested in looking at right now. So at this point, I should probably stop because I'm running out of time. And really, I just want to finish by saying, effectively what I said is that non-Gaussian statistics are fun. Like, you can learn more information from them. And we're now in an interesting era in which we can actually make use of them. We've got estimators that enable us to measure these guys, and we have models which actually work very well, and we can extract more information from large-scale structure without any additional cost. And we do not need any new observables. We simply make better use of the galaxy data sets we've got. So at this point, I'll say thank you very much, and I'm very happy to answer any further questions.
All right, wow, perfect timing, Oliver. That was great. Okay, so let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for his great talk. Okay, so any further? I see that Kendrick already has his hand raised. Yeah, so go ahead, Kendrick.
Thanks, Oliver. This was an amazing talk.
Thanks very much.
I'll try to, I could probably ask questions for like an hour, but we're talking for an hour tomorrow. But I'll just ask one question, which is that seemed like for the 3-point galaxy analysis, you were including the 1-point term in the estimator. But for the 4-point analysis, you are not including the analogous 2-point term in the estimator. Is that right?
Sort of. So it's interesting. So large scale structure, the 3-point function estimator should have a 1-point piece. So it should have a piece, basically subtract the power spectrum times the density field. Which people almost always ignore. Like the new estimators finally include these terms, and it gives you slightly better behavior on very large scales. But in fact, for the 4-point function pieces, we are actually including two-point pieces. And that comes from these, there's two forms of two-point pieces. There's one that comes from removing this Gaussian piece, and there's also another one which comes from just making this optimal. The one for optimality, I don't think we have included, but could be interesting to consider.
So I wanted to recommend including this term. So in addition to, so something that I think is, I think this term is a lot more important in the four-point context than the three-point context.
For the
following reason, that it's doing two things at once. It's making the estimator more optimal and improving the error bar a bit, which is not so important. But it also has the underappreciated property that if you've mismodeled the Gaussian covariance, like say the true covariance matrix is like the covariance matrix that you think you have plus some correction delta C. Then the bias to the four-point function will be parametrically of order delta C or delta C squared, depending on whether you do not or do include this term.
Interesting.
And so it's way more robust to things like getting like RSDs right and like nonlinear RSDs and modeling the galaxy bias and stuff like that.
Okay. Oh, very interesting. I should look into that. Excellent. Thank you very much.
So that's why, like in the CMB context, where four-point function is like way more mainstream, this term is kind of a practical necessity.
Interesting. Okay, that sounds great. Look into that.
Were you guys finished? Because Simon also has his hand raised. So Simon, go ahead.
Great, thanks. Hi, Oliver. It's a really nice talk. I had two questions. The first one is about constraining non-Gaussianity using the galaxy bias spectrum.
Yeah.
I remember at some point there was a forecasting paper by Enrico Pyer and his students that concluded that results that had kind of a pessimistic conclusion, particularly for equilateral non-Gaussianity, that the primordial piece is going to be pretty degenerate with higher order pieces just for gravity.
Yeah.
And anecdotally, I think those results were pessimistic enough for some people to kind of get really depressed and say, oh, well, it's not, you know, I don't have strong hopes for particularly that shape of non-Gaussianity.
Yeah.
Have there been advances since then which might allow for the prospects of beating these forecasts, or is it still kind of the same story?
Yeah, so I think you actually do slightly better than a lot of the forecasts say, simply because it's mostly the fact that we've got degeneracies between bias parameters and FNL, important on large scale, but those same bias parameters also enter in the power spectrum model. And we do actually get some constraints on them from the power spectrum, which is gonna reduce the degeneracies in the bias spectrum. And a lot of the forecasts, I think, really just consider the bias spectrum. So they're getting rid of that extra source of information. Like that constraint of equilateral plus or minus 500, that's a constraint from kind of the first run we did of the actual data. So that's realistic to what we will be expecting when we finally get the actual answer.
Okay, great, thanks. And then question two, just quickly. You mentioned this joint power spectrum bias spectrum analysis.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that covariance? Is it for mocks or analytics?
Yep. So the joint, so we do a full covariance just from the mocks. So like there are things like the power spectrum, but power spectrum and bias spectrum are covariant. In perturbation theory, that it's zero, but it turns out to actually be quite important. But we get all that just from 2,000 mock surveys.
Okay. Perfect. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks very much.
So Jesse, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about, so your discussion of your work on the window function deconvolution for the bias spectrum, and just want to make sure I understand the context for that. So naively, I would think that the window function would be easier to handle in coordinate space.
Yep.
Is that right? And like, how should I think about the trade-off between working in Fourier and real space for the bias spectrum?
Yeah. So yeah, we have a trade-off that we have to pay. It's in real space, in Fourier space, the mask is much more complicated. The window function is a problem. In real space, the trade-off is how we do the theory. So the theory models are naturally constructed in Fourier space, simply because your early universes, every mode is uncorrelated in Fourier space. The fundamental thing we get is an estimate for the Fourier space bi spectrum. And then if we want to do a real space analysis, we have to then do a Fourier transform on that. And that actually is quite non-trivial, simply because it's a triple Fourier transform with some Dirac functions as well. It's doable, but again, that pays a computational price. If you want to do alternative things like measuring things from simulations or emulator prescriptions, probably the real space correlation functions are actually a much better way to do it, just because you don't have these theoretical hurdles to overcome. But yeah, for now, like, I mean, I see this mostly from the modeling side, the theory side, so we generally tend to prefer the Fourier space stuff.
Okay, awesome. I also have some questions, but I see that we're like 7 past the hour, so maybe in the interest of time, let's stop the official recorded seminar here. So Oliver, if you can stay on, that would be great, but yeah, if you sure. can't, also fine, yeah. Okay, so let's thank Oliver again.
Thanks for watching.